obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Paula, and I am an alcoholic. You know, it's been a long time since I did that alcoholic prayer. God, get me through this one, and I'll never do it again. But that's exactly how it feels being up here. And I can start out with my sobriety date is March 1st, 2001, and I want to thank Stephanie for asking us to come out here. It's really, really cool because she told me to pick some readers. So my head is like all day long. It's like, you know, I don't know how many of you guys detoxed off of alcohol, but you know how shaky you are on the outside? That's how my insides feel. You know I have a God, and I know I have a lot of support. I want to thank everybody. If it's your first time being at a convention, we're going to have a good time all weekend long. You know, we do numerous of these things through the year. And for me, I've been around for a few days in a row again. My sobriety date, or wait, let's do this real quick. I'll get that all out. Okay, that might not happen again for a while, but I can't promise it. Okay, so my sobriety date is March 1st, 2001, and I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And, you know, I have a treatment facility that when I first arrived into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was so sick, they had to drive me to meetings, you know, and that's just the bottom line. That's how sick I was. If you told me to get from Orangethorpe over to Commonwealth, I would not have made it, you know, and that's just the truth of it. And I'm really, really grateful for that facility and all the other facilities. I know there's probably people that are here for the weekend and you come from a facility and they bring you over here to show you we're not a glum lot. We have a good time. You know, some of you guys are maybe alumni from, and if you're anything like me, you're probably alumni from 3 or 4, you know. You know, I don't know what your deal is. I just know that I want to extend my hand and welcome you to the greatest show on earth, and that's what it's been for me, you know. I don't know, they say I have to qualify. I definitely qualify. I could just pull my skirt up and say this is what it was like, but you guys want to hear what it was like, so I have to tell you. And you know, that's just the truth of it. That's kind of tacky. My old man like sits down in his seat a little bit every time I say that. But that's the truth of it. You know, I grew up in a pretty dysfunctional family. That's not what made me an alcoholic. You know what I mean? The yelling, the verbal abuse, the physical abuse, that's not what made me an alcoholic. I knew from the people in my lives that when there were situations going on, good or bad, there was a drinker, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Drugs are a big part of my story. I'm not going to talk a lot about drugs because I do respect this program. And I can tell you that if you're anything like me, it started out with alcohol and ended with alcohol. You know, anything else I found on the way was just a free-for-all. You know, it was just, let's do it. I suffer from the disease of more, and my preference is, what do you got? You know, so I'm not real particular. I'll hear some people get up here and they'll say, well, I wouldn't even drink with you people. I would if you were buying, you know. That's just my deal. That's how I live my life, you know. And at a real young age, I knew that. You know, I was taught good qualities for sociably unacceptable behavior like lying and cheating and manipulating. And that's what I was raised on. And I got real good at it. You know what I mean? And at that young age, I can remember, I'm just going to talk about like some of the feelings. I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of drug-a-log. I didn't miss a whole bunch. You know, I tried everything. There's not a whole bunch I missed. But really, what I think is important for us to be able to relate. So, you know, just the way that I thought and how I felt at a very young age, you know. And I can remember coming home from grade school, and I'd be walking home, and I'd kind of like really, really take my time because what was going on at home wasn't all that fun. You know, I didn't know it at that age, but now I have something to identify with. It's called those masks. You know what I mean? I can go to school, I can show up, I can do what they want me to do, and I can kind of sort of act right, you know? And I went to school, I got fairly decent grades. I didn't stick with it very long. You know, I'm not an overachiever. And I remember walking home, and I remember looking, you know, as you're walking by houses in the neighborhood, and I remember thinking I would rather be in any of those houses than mine. You know, I honestly felt like maybe a mothership. Seriously, at one time I thought like I was just dropped off on this earth for I don't know what, and they'd be back to get me. You know, and I don't know if you think like that, but that's exactly how I felt as a young child. And I don't know. You know, life just went on. You know, it was what it was. I can remember some days I'd come home from grade school and there'd be 20 Harley Davidsons parked in the front yard, you know, and a couple weeks later there'd be a whole bunch of lowriders in the front yard, you know, and a little bit later they decide to do some work on the house and there'd be 20 drunk Mexicans with five trash cans this big full of beer, and we'd have a new sidewalk, you know. Stuff like that happened at my house, and you never really knew what you were in for at the end of the day. And I can tell you that walking through the door, I'm a really, really good judge of character. I'm real good at looking around and seeing what's going on and get a feel for things, you know. And, you know, that spirituality was with me at that young age, you know. I mean, honestly, it was there. I'm the one that took the left. You know, God never left me and all that. I knew there was a God. I didn't know how to get to him. And I wasn't sure when I got here if I wanted to sit still very long because I knew I owed. You know, and maybe not at that young age, but I was just different. I was different from my fellows. I can relate to that. Maladjusted to life. You know, the doctor's opinion talks about quite a few good things. You know, if you haven't had a chance to go through that, please, if you could feel what's in my heart, you'd grab that book and you'd start doing what it says today. You know, you start out to, you can say thank you tonight and please in the morning. It can be that simple, you know, and you know, growing up, there wasn't a lot of God. We weren't fed a lot of God. There was this really neat lady who knocked at the door quite often, and she would take me away from our house, and she would give me little children Bible studies. You know, so I knew there was something good. You know, it just wasn't at my house, you know, and it wasn't all bad all the time. You know, we had all the material stuff that we needed. They did the very best that they could do with what they were working with. You know, and there's a lot of closure in that. Once you can come to those conclusions, man, there's some freedom. And, you know, not knowing that growing up, 9 years old, my little brother passed away. And I'm the oldest of, at that time, it was five. So I was, like, solely kind of sort of responsible. I can remember giving him his first bath, you know, and I wasn't very old. We're probably 6 or 7 years old. You know, the first time I gave him a bath, should I say, not his first bath, but... And I remember taking care of that little boy, and I remember holding him, and I remember I could take care of him, you know. I could do something. If I messed up with everybody else, this little boy I could help, you know. And that little boy passed away. He died a crib death. And nobody said it in so many words, but what I felt and what I thought at such a young age, very impressionable, was that I wasn't worthy of that kind of love. That was not the kind of love that was in the cards for me, you know. I didn't shut my mind on God. I didn't hate God. I didn't, you know, the word hate wasn't really in my vocabulary. I learned that later, if you know what I'm saying. And, you know, it just was what it was. And it was an empty time at my house. And I can remember my stepdad, I seen tears on his face, you know. And I never seen this man cry or show any emotion at all. And we were driving back from the funeral, and he had tears on his face. And I can remember... when the ambulance and the, you know, everybody's like the emergency team and so much and so forth are there, and my mom's in the street with the baby and they're trying to bring him back. He's not coming back. And I can remember literally walking over to the refrigerator. Must have been anywhere between 7 and 9, you know, when I knew it would work, you know. And I remember walking over there, and I remember the Budweiser on the shelf, and I remember popping it, and it was them old caps, and it curled up around my finger. And I remember hitting it. I don't think that I drank the whole thing right then and there, but I knew I felt some kind of relief. You know, I didn't pick up again for quite a few years. You know, well, not quite a few years, I'll say a minute. Probably like from 9 to 12. And then at 12 years old, I was introduced to other things, you know. And at 12 and 13 years old, it's like the fun is this big and the consequences is this big. You know, I went out to a party at, let's say, 12 and a half, and I didn't come to until I was 35, you know, and that's just how it was for me. Like, those years, I couldn't tell you what year it was. I know there was a big celebration for 76. I know I was in a drill team, but other than that, there was a lot of fog in my life, you know, and still to this day. And when I was 15, I was blessed with a beautiful baby boy. His name's Joshua. He was born... January 18th, 1981, I was 15 years old. You know, some bad decisions, whatever the case may be, drugs and alcohol and boys go hand in hand for me. I'm going to give you as much of my story as I feel comfortable in mixed company, but when I share for just women, there's a little bit more than that than I care to put out on the table right here, right now. So if you got stuff in your story that you need to put out there, you want to find some friends, some closed mouth friends, and you want to be able to do that in the privacy of no judgment, okay? Because you get a reputation around here in the rooms of AA, and it follows you. It really does follow you. We're all sick. This is not the bedrock of mental health. And, you know, I was taught that early on. You know, I didn't know that in the beginning. Thank God a woman cared enough for, you know, actually what she did. Well, I'll go into that a little bit later. So when that little boy, I'm trying to avoid the issue here so I don't have to feel no feelings. You guys see that? Straight disease at its finest. Yeah, because then I'll have to feel, you know. That little boy was born, they told me to put him in an institution, forget I ever had him, and if I wanted to have a decent life, that he was going to be a burden for all of my life. And then they asked me that magical question that they ask us, you know, they said, did you use drugs and alcohol when you were pregnant? And I didn't use the whole time. What it was before I found out I was pregnant, I was on a good one. And that first 3 weeks, that first trimester is really, really important. And I know there's women in the rooms and they say, I drank and used all the way through my pregnancy and my child is so bright. That's just not my story. You know, that's not my story. And he lives on with his message. You know, this is his message to you guys. He's not here. He couldn't talk. He couldn't walk. And, you know, I have a vendetta against this disease on a daily basis. I'm mad at this disease. I got robbed. You know, and I'd like to say, oh, that was enough to sober me up and that's how it went, but that's not what happened. You know, I was as good of a mom as I could be for like 3 years. I remember showing up and, you know, I mentioned earlier a little bit about those masks. So here I am, I'm a what they call a SAM, school age mother program. I'm doing what I need for my grades. This is at the age of 16. We're taking him to like 12 different doctors and specialists and, you know, infant STEM classes and therapy, and we're doing all this stuff. So I'm doing all these adult things with this child, which was not a big deal. It wasn't a hassle. What would kill me inside was I was carrying all these secrets, and I never, ever knew how to say, I've been hurt, could you help me? I didn't know how to do that. So I'm showing up to these places with this child, and they're giving me all these credits, these pats on the back, like I'm such a good mom. You know, and the spiritual malady I have inside of me still to this day is I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy of. I'm less than. I'll never match up. You know, and I carried that with me for a long time. And I remember, you know, I would go and we would do all that stuff. And pretty soon it started like, okay, it's okay to have a drink. You know, and it wasn't like it was offered to me. My parents had these real pretty fancy expensive bottles stored in their room up on the shelf. And on Friday night or so, I just, you know, not a whole bunch because I didn't want to get caught, but a drink here and there. And I started mixing water with it because that's who I am, you know. And there was a lot of outside issues around. And I knew where they were. You know, I can remember being 12 and 13 years old going into the room, into the lockbox and bagging some stuff up for people. That's what I was taught to do. You know, it was easy for me to do. I knew how. I had real good teachers early on. This is what you do to get by and to survive in life. And, you know, those sips here and there start turning into Friday night out, getting caught drunk when mom would babysit, you know, and then it would turn into Friday and Saturday night. And then like 3 and 4 years later, I'm staying gone for 4 or 5 days at a time. You know, when he was 6 years old, solid, and I remember this like it was yesterday, I remember being out what I was doing with the people I was doing it with, blaming my parents and all that stuff at home for why it's okay for me to break the rules, for why it's okay for me to move my boundaries, for why it's okay and you owe me and I'm collecting. And I was coming up with these ideas, you know. There was a time when I remember I'd be drinking and I knew I needed to sober up at a certain time to go home and be with that boy. I knew that. That was a given. You know, I wasn't doing nothing and I could stick to it. And then there was a that where I crossed that magic line, and my head would tell me that I absolutely had to be under the influence to care for this child. So it kind of turned on me, you know, and I remember when that happened, you know, and I remember being out, and I hadn't been home for like 2 or 3 days, and, you know, I'm over 18 now, and I decided to marry somebody. I turned 18, 3 days after I turned 18, I married somebody. We went to Las Vegas. We got married at Circus Circus, and I was working the boulevard and, we'll say, slamming whiskey by October. And that's just how fast it happened for me, you know. And this little boy was with me, and we were doing all the best that we can and getting on, and it wasn't really that, you know. Nobody ever said, oh, the consequences of this are, you know, that reefer mania where you start out smoking weed and pretty soon you're doing H. That's my story, you know. And, you know, I never meant for it to be like that. I was just trying to shut this off. I don't know if you guys drink and use like I drink and use. I have a spiritual malady, and drugs and alcohol are the only thing that will shut this down. That's the only solution I got up until that point in my life, you know, and I do the best that I can with what I'm working with, and it ain't much. And, you know, I come to that moment of clarity that night, and I went over to my mom's house, and I picked up my son. And the very next morning, I made arrangements with a regional center and CPS for me to have a weekend break. And I took that little boy and I dropped him off, you know. And for the longest time, at least 10 years, from 90, I mean, I don't know, that was like the late 80s. He was like 6 or 7. So then they give you opportunity. The state of California on court papers, what it says is indigent, alcoholic, addict, mother, abandoned child is exactly how it looks, you know. And that's what it looked like. And today I know, after working this program, that was probably the most selfless act I've ever done in my miserable existence, was to let that boy have a safe place to be, you know. And it wasn't me, and it surely wasn't because it was a sober decision. It was just something that came about me, and those are the actions I took. I did the very best that I could. And the state of California gives you time and time and time again to get it together. They'll help you. You know, there was a lot of things that I wasn't willing to work out. That's my honest and thorough first step. I'm kind of bouncing around here a little bit, but right here while we're at that point, I want to tell you that if I had a choice to go get my son or continue to drink and use, I would have picked go get my son. You know, I would have picked go get my son. So that is my 100%. And they say that the first step is the step that you must do 100%, 100% of the time. That's the one. Now, if you work the rest of them, life gets really, really good. But you better get that one down, okay? So, you know, that's my one, and I just wanted to share that because it's really, really important to me. That's the power of this disease. This disease is so powerful, it will rip a brand new baby out of the loving arms of a mother. And that's how powerful it is. And I know I'm not the only one in here. I see a few heads nodding. You guys, it's an honor and a privilege to do this deal, and I try to stay on the firing lines for that purpose alone. I mean, it's a horrific tragedy to think that I could have been the one to cause that little boy to not ever have a righteous life, you know? And I had a lot of self-searching to do, and a lot of soul, and a lot of work to do, and, you know, I'd be sharing in women's meetings, and thank God for this lady, and I really didn't like her at the time. You'll find a lot about it, a lot like that around here. And after I shared, she pulled me aside, she gave me a big hug, she wiped the tears off my eyes, and she told me, get off the cross, honey, we need the wood. Wow. What a concept. You know, and what she told me after that was, you need to get busy living or you're going to get busy dying. And if you don't forgive yourself, nobody else will. You know, I hadn't been around long enough to get the magic. I probably had like 2 months sober when that was going on. And I was in the meeting, and I was beating myself up with no solution, so they gave it to me, you know, and that's how it's worked for me. Like, honestly, it's come pretty, you know, they say this stuff is really, really hard to do, but you didn't get loaded like I got loaded. Handing that boy over to the state of California, signing them papers and pushing them back across the table, that's hard. For the decade after that, trying to die out there, that was hard. You know, I started finding probation, felony probation, Of course, I got on parole, but when I handed that little boy over, there wasn't a bottle or a bag big enough. I don't know if you can relate to that, but that's just how it was for me. You know, and I didn't have the nerve to take my own life. You know, I don't know where I got the idea that might be a bad idea. You know, I was slowly trying to kill myself, and I was hanging out with a whole bunch of people that I was doing dirty, and they would have loved to have done the job a few times. You know, but for some reason, God spared me. You know, I am not supposed to be before you for whatever the case may be. Some of the things and situations that I put myself in when I was in the disease, and today I can say I put myself in. It didn't happen to me. I didn't lose my son. And the women in the rooms taught me that too, that my self-talk is everything. If I walk around saying I lost my son, I have no accountability in that. I'm not responsible. I'm dislocated from the amends. You know, I have to have a part in this stuff if I'm going to do it. And, you know, when I signed those papers and I was running around and I was doing what I was doing and I tried for a solid decade to die, I wanted to die. I can remember waking up in various places and I can remember doing some things that I'm not proud of. You know, and most of it was under the influence. I made a lot of bad choices. You know, it's like one big blur. You know, I go to my neighborhood. It's funny because I'll go to my neighborhood. Oh, I was raised in Midway City. It's a real small, unincorporated town over. There's like a post office and a friggin' fire department, and that's it. And you blink and you'll miss it. That's where I was raised at. And today I go over there like I ran those streets and I knew which fences to jump and who had dogs in their backyard when I'm under the influence. But I go over to the day, and I'm in a car with a freaking map, and I can't find my way around there, you know? So I know I was running around pretty much just obliviated most of the time. And, you know, I did what I had to do, and I believe wholeheartedly with every fiber of my being that drugs and alcohol saved my life until I could get to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for you guys to love me back to life. You know, and that's just my deal. And, there's just so much to be said, and I knew I had a good story when I got here. You know, when I got here, I landed in detox on February 27th. That's not what I call my sobriety date, because I was good and under the influence for a couple of days, so I came to on March 1st, and that morning meditation is really important to me, the 24-hour, because on my date, it said, and I can still remember, and every time I read it, it brings tears to my eyes, am I willing to handle the drink problem over to God and not take it back, you know? And I love that reading. And that was the first day I heard something. You know, if I had one more hustle or one more game or one more brilliant idea, I wouldn't be here. I would have missed all this. You know, so when I got to that detox, my whole reason for being in that detox was not because I was just wanted to become a good person, or it wasn't about my life was salvageable. It wasn't about getting my son back in my life, which you people did for me. You know, it was about my old man was fighting 25 to life. We'd been together for 18 years. He wasn't the one that I married when I was 18. That relationship ended because I was out robbing tricks, and he pulled a purse snatching from a little old lady, and I just can't hold that. You know what I mean? I'm tougher than that. I'm better than that. We can't roll like that, you know, and that's the whole reason why that relationship ended, you know. So then when this new relationship started, which was in 1986, and I know that only because my grandfather passed away in 86, and I went to his funeral, but I went, we'll say Malia's, if you know what it is, cool, if you don't, you don't. We don't need to go into the details of it. And I remember wanting to crawl out of my skin, wanting to get out of the vehicle, back to the neighborhood so I could get what I had to get to feel better. And I bring that about because not once did I think about, oh, my poor grandma. Not once did I think about my aunts and uncles are devastated for this loss. Not once did I realize this is the only real man I've had in my life and he's gone now. You know, that's not what I was thinking about. I was completely consumed with this disease, and I was a taker, 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 even at that time. And the next one that I picked, he had 25 felony arrests and no convictions, so I made him my man. Yeah. His name was Dennis, and he was a gentleman's gentleman. He did the street thing, but he had something different than me. He had honesty. He had loyalty. He was caring. all the things we were doing were wrong, but he went about it right. That's not, he was what they call a stand-up guy, a solid wood. That's what they called us. I mean, them. So we were together, and four terms later, he was fighting 25 to life. You know, they caught him with a little bit, and they wanted to slam him down for 25. And, like, I didn't know what to do, really. I was going to go to detox, try to clean up, go to court, say it was mine, because it really was. So were the other three terms, but I wasn't willing or woman enough to stand up and say that then. You know, I just wasn't done, and I'd already given up that little boy, and I had absolutely nothing to live for. And that was my very last stab. And on February 27th, the morning of going to that detox, I remember having a shot in this hand and a shot in this hand. And the only reason why he would allow me to have whiskey that morning is because I lied to him and I told him that you had to be an alcoholic to go to this detox so I could get one more drink in me, you know. But the amazing thing happened a few minutes later. I remember standing in front of the mirror, and I absolutely had to be under the influence of some sort to take an eyeliner and put two. And I remember looking in the mirror, and I remember loathing who I was and everything about me. And I can remember that last week of not really having a safe place to go. At any given moment, we could, there's, you know, raids, robberies, whatever's going on out there, and we're right in the heart of it. And it's not like we're hiding or we're good at it. You know, everybody knows who we are and what we're doing. I love you, Mo. Mm-hmm. There's so many people in here who've helped me become the woman that I am. I want to thank you all. So that morning, and he said, we got this thing between me and him, like clean up a little bit, kind of, you know, oh, now I have words to it. It's called recuperate. So if you're in these rooms, ask yourself, are you here to recuperate or are you here to recover? Because there is a choice around here. You know, I didn't know that then. You know, I just wanted to get the heat off a little bit. You know, I wasn't sure what was going to come out of it. I had no idea I'd be standing here 13 years later. I guarantee you that. I didn't come to stay. I went to that detox facility, and I was sick enough. Okay, this is how I really, really knew I was an alcoholic. Backpedal a little bit. On October, and I can remember these days because I was somewhat sober, you know what I mean, or sober-ish. See, if you're not putting guns to people's heads or doing outside stuff, and I'm just drinking a little alcohol and smoking a little meth to get off the hard stuff, then I'm kind of sober. You know, I'm sober. So I'm sober. And, no, I remember leaving CIW, that wonderful place, also known as Cows, Insects, and Women. Every once in a while, you'll get a cons, inmates, and wannabes out of it. And it's a wonderful place that they like to keep girls like I who can't play well with others. And I remember leaving there, and I know it was October 18th, the year 2000. And I remember leaving there, and I remember going home and hugging Grandma. And it was probably like a 9-month little violation I did, you know. It wasn't my longest violation, but it was the one. When I was there that 9 months, I started doing, once a week they let CODA come in there, they let NA come in there, they have AA in there. I had a lifer take me through steps 1 through 6 in Narcotics Anonymous because I wasn't aware of me being an alcoholic. When I arrived at Grandma's house, I did what every hardcore tough girl does. And I went to Grandma's refrigerator to eat, because that's what we do. And I opened the refrigerator, and I remember there was a 12-pack of beer. It was probably like even Pabst Blue Ribbon, because it was her boyfriend's beer. I would like to think it was Budweiser, but that's probably my pride and ego. It was probably Pabst Blue Ribbon. And I remember saying to her, I'm not going to go out. I'm just going to have one beer, Grandma. And you know what? They don't know. My family doesn't know. The state doesn't know. The state can't even give me alcohol stipulations. They didn't even fill me in, you know. But I took that beer, and that beer turned into a 12-pack, and I got out on a Thursday, and I was supposed to go to parole on Friday. So I guess it'd be like the 20, 21st, and that evening on, it's probably like a Tuesday, I landed at my sister's house in Garden Grove across the street from one of my favorite bars. And I knocked on her door, and I remember going in, eating all of her leftovers, passing out, and getting up in the morning and looking in the mirror and saying, what the heck happened to the girl who just paroled 4 days ago? You know, and I knew it had been 4 days for the simple fact of I was drinking straight tequila last night. I hadn't reported to parole, and I probably got a foul warrant now. So that's the only reason why I can identify, like, what went on that weekend. And I would like to tell you that I sobered up and got on Beam, and that's not what happened. You know, I woke up that monkey and I had to go for another 4 months. Now, fast forward to February 27th. So I land in this little detox, and I didn't know. They offered me, instead of a seven-day detox, I was sick enough to get cleared for a 10-day detox. I did the cold turkey detox. Thank God, if you would put me on meds, I wouldn't be here right now. That's just my deal. I don't know how you got to do it, but I know how I got to do it. The thing about medical detox for a chick like me is I go into a place to get meds, to get off some stuff. Now I'm on some stuff for a few days. You're going to release me, and I haven't detoxed from the stuff that you gave me to detox from the other stuff. So automatically, I owe myself one. You know, and that sounded like if you followed that little deal right there, you're sicker than most. Okay? And this is what we do. But God forbid I don't want to get sick. You know, we got a saying out there, I got to get well. For years, I got to get well, got to get well. Until we become aware of the disease of alcoholism, we're just prolonging the illness, but we don't know that. You know, so I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, a lot of bit here. I did that 10 days in detox. They did not have a bed in that facility. What they did was they took out a twin bed and put in a set of bunk beds. So they gave me an opportunity to be there. And, you know, I didn't ask for any of this stuff, but I do know that when they offered it to me, my head said, oh, crap, now you gotta stay. You know, that was the very best I could do. I have a sick, unhealthy loyalty to that place, but I love it because it's on the firing lines. I love that place. And, you know, they spoon-fed me this thing. You know, you hear right away, get a sponsor. There's no messing around there. We're in that book like 3-5 times a day. You know, we add some other stuff to it, but we're in there. We get a morning meditation. We get a morning group. We get a lunch, we get an afternoon meeting, we come home, we do another group, we have a dinner, and then we do a group again. And it's all about big book, you know? I like to say I slam steps like I slam whiskey, and some people get a kick out of that. But that's what they gave me, is a working knowledge. You know, they did that. They set the foundation. We went to outside meetings. Like I said, I was so sick, I couldn't have got to a meeting. You know, if you're in here and you made it down here on your own tonight, and you actually got here and you're kind of sort of sick or your head wants a drink, we need to give all of you guys, give whoever that person is a round of applause right now.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And I want to welcome you to a brand new life. You know, I got busy, real busy. I had 90 days to focus. I had nothing else going on. One magical thing happened for him is Westcourt strike to strike, and they gave him a deal, my significant other at that time, and he went off to prison, and he was going to be gone, I don't know, they gave him like 32, so he would have done like 28 months. And last conversation we had on the telephone was, and now what are you going to do, girl? You know, I mean, we didn't talk about God a lot, but we knew he got a favor, and we knew he got a kick, and in his, one of the last question or statements that he said to me was, and what are you going to do, girl? Because, you know, you got to find a different way to do this deal. And I agreed, you know. So when they offered me that bed, I stayed there. And when I had, you know, that first year of picking up that first year sober, I was probably sponsoring girls. And I'm not up here like pride and ego or anything. I'm just telling you how sick I am and how much I have to do around here. And, you know, I was involved in intergroup, a little bit of panels. You know, I wasn't old enough to be at an H&I member yet, and my schedule conflict with it, but they were taking me on panels at like 4 months sober. I was reading with girls in books at 4 months sober, sitting across the table. I was into 3 women's meetings a week. I did not mess around, and I did almost everything that the treatment facility did, you know, at the same time. So it was like we got a lot done, you know, and I did that for like 3 years. And, you know, at 2 years sober, I can tell you, and kind of sort of like just like the feelings and the emotions and the changes that happen. I remember having this idea that I'm just going to stay here and I'm going to do this stuff like you asked me to do it. So if I do it and something goes wrong, I can blame you. That was my whole solution, you know. And I just successfully, like, just showed up. And even when I'm down, you know, I'd show up no matter what my head told me. And they, like, they didn't tell me what to do around here. They showed me what to do. You know, I told you about when I was a child, like, I'm real good at adjusting the situation. You know what I mean? I can walk in and feel things out, know if it's a good day or a bad day or something's going on. And that's pretty much what I did. I mean, those were the only skills I had. I had willingness and the ability to watch the people around me when I got here, you know. And today I know there's only one ability God wants me to have, and that's availability. And I'd like to tell you that I'm here and I'm on the firing lines all the time. And I'm really going to tell you the truth. If you plan on staying sober, just figure you're going to be inconvenienced quite often. You know? It's going to be an inconvenience somewhere throughout the day. And I don't know, I just feel so blessed and so fortunate, you know. And if you would have told me that I was going to be speaking at the Orange County Convention 13 years ago, I would have told you you were crazy. And, you know, God's not done yet. You know, that gentleman passed away. A lot of us have this solution. I don't know if any of you do, but my best solution was send me back to the joint. When I get out, it'll be different. Or I'll just go to jail, and when I get out, it'll be different, you know. That gentleman went to jail, and in 2003, he passed away. He died of spinal meningitis. He never made it home. So then again, his story becomes my story. I get to tell you that we don't always make it home. Maybe our best solution at the moment, but we don't always get to come home. And, you know, I can tell you that when he passed away, I was kind of like upset with some of the newer people that I see coming in, going out, coming in, going out, coming in, going out. Not that I'd been here that long, but just what we see around here. You know, with this, oh, they said, grab yourself a seat on the bleacher and watch the passing parade. You know, I didn't quite know what that meant when they said it, but I'm a listener, so, you know, I got an idea of what was going on. It takes a while for this stuff to set in, but when it does, it does. There's a few things that I sold early on in those couple of years, and I want to share them with you, and then we'll go on to some pretty amazing closure that God has allowed me to have. And, one of the first things that I remember hearing besides get off the cross, we need the wood, that one set real well with me. But another one was, I can't think my way into better living. I have to live my way into better thinking. And another one that I stole, uncover, discover, discard, and recover. You know, and I have not an original thought left. You guys have thoroughly brainwashed me. You should give yourselves a round of applause. You know, thank you. And I'm still a straight thief. I steal stuff all day long. I apply it and give it away. You know, and that's just what I've done. And I'm, like, thirsty. I was really, really thirsty when I got here, like a sponge. I didn't know my life would change. I didn't know it could change. I had no idea of the life that I was going to get to live. You know, and that's just, it's just as a direct result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 traditions, and you wonderful people in these rooms. Fast forward a little bit, 2 years sober, I remember thinking, I'm just going to come here and do what you tell me to do if anything goes wrong. 2 years sober, I got off, that gentleman passed away, and a few months later, I got off parole. And my whole deal was, I'm going to get sober, I'm going to do this stuff, I'm going to get off parole, and then I'm going to go out there. So when I got that mail in my hand, my stepsister brought it over from my stepdad's house, and at the meeting place, I got frequented at a place called the meeting place. Some of you guys may know about it, some of you don't. They say, nobody stays sober out of the meeting place. That's what they used to say. I'm here to tell you different. You know, we have that little rivalry thing going on. Us alcoholics, we love that crap, don't we? Don't we love that? Ours is better than yours. I'm sicker than you. Yeah, we love that. Oh, yeah, badge of honor. Okay, so where am I at? Oh, yeah, discharge heart. So I remember getting it, and I remember jumping so high I almost knocked the ceiling out, and I'm not exaggerating. And I remember thinking, you know, I got my first little car. I never even had a driver's license. You guys, you got me in the shape of state number, bad attitude, no driver's license, completely unemployable, can't even get from the fellowship to the meeting, you know, lost completely, you know, in the middle, not knowing who's who or what's what, no living skills whatsoever, nothing on paper, you know, except for a C file, and that's how you guys got me. And by this time I had the little car. Somebody gave me a car for a year sober, and I agreed to manage a women's sober living house for him in payment of. My first sponsor told me, do not, well, okay, so we're doing this little fifth step, right? And then we get sixth step, I know what my character defects are, seventh step, get to the eighth step amends, and I'm like, how do you pay back all these people? This is what she told me. You put your hand out to every woman who walks through the door and treat them like a lady. And she said, and stay the hell away from the men. And I wasn't allowed to accept any gifts from any guys or any help financially. And she was an angel, literally an angel. And her name's Rachel. And when I had 13 months, I kind of jumping around here. When I had 13 months sober, she decided to go take a drink. And this is a common courtesy the lady had. The night after she drank, she called me right away the next morning. She said, Paula, you need to get another sponsor. And then no more than a half hour later, my grand sponsor called me. And all she asked me was, are you angry at her? And I said, I don't know that I'm angry at her, but I'm kind of scared. And she said, well, it's okay to be angry, but I want you to direct it at the disease and not at the individual. And that was a really helpful hint, you know. And then talking to other people in the program, and here's some things we've stolen and we like to share around here. Those that matter won't mind. And those that mind don't matter. Be careful how you treat the newcomer. They may be your sponsor one day. And we don't shoot our wounded. And I learned those things, you know, and I honor them and I embrace them, you know. But for the grace of God, there go I, you know. But for the grace of God. When I say I'm an alcoholic, there's a responsibility that comes along with that statement to me. You know, and I mean, we have our little pledge too. I am responsible for the hand of AA being there. I'm sure that's not exactly how it goes, but the responsibility that I have to be is I need to be responsible for my actions, my side of the street, how I treat people. In 2003, when Dennis passed away, it was kind of devastating, you know, and then I got off parole, and I remember thinking, you know, my life is so much better than it was. I had my little get well, feel good job. I had my little, you know, my little sober beast, and, you know, I decided to not follow through. So that was my last reservation that I had actually made, you know, to myself, you know, and of course, those are the ones you never tell anybody else. You know, you're not going to tell that one. That was the one secret that I kept to me. That was probably the only secret that I kept to me, because I mean, my cards are all out on the table today, and there's a lot of parts of my story that I know for a fact I am straight blessed, because there is a lot of women who walk into the rooms of AA, and if there's 25 of us sitting there, I know that uniquely God has graced me with a story to help numerous women that other women can't. And that's just the truth for me. And then I hear Roxy's voice in the back of my head. Roxy used to be the central, the office manager. It's central office, I mean, yeah. And she was there for years, and she taught me a lot about service work. You know, I'm conducively doing the steps. I'm a lot of service. And I started to get back into Joshua's life, and at 3 years sober, I was offered this opportunity to manage a women's sober living house, but it was really, really close to my neighborhood. So I talked to Roxy about it, and she said, yeah, I think it's a good reason to be of service, you know. Not too much went on in my life without me talking to. If not my sponsor, I have a real good support group for different areas. So I have people to talk to, you know. And I think the importance for me is, like, you need to have a home group, a hardcore group of people. Because pretty soon, like, I can go across Orange County, you know, and my pride and ego will step in, but I need to be around, you know, I could go to South County and pick up a 20-year chip and sound real good doing it, if you know what I mean, which is far-fetched, but my people around me know me, You know, my people around me know me and they call me on my stuff. And there's half the room's filled with the people who help me with that. And it takes all of them. And I don't know, just something about that whole deal with being of service and being of service and being of service. And I got that opportunity to be of service. And it was a decision that I made just to help other women. And by now I'd been in my son's life and I was going by his school, or no, his house on the weekends. And I would see him, you know, like a Friday and Saturday. And I can tell you when I started going over there and seeing him, I was so devastated and remorseful and full of guilt and shame. And some days I could stay for an hour and other days I could stay for 4 hours. The couple times I went up there, I checked on him, I kissed him, and it was so overwhelming, the emotions and the cause and the effect and the devastation, you know, I would have to leave. And I would just do the best that I could, and I'd suit up and I'd show up. No matter how long I'd stay, I'd be there. And, you know, I started to acquire a little relationship with him. Pretty soon I could only stay for a little bit, and it got longer and longer and longer, and I could spend some quality time with him. And the other children in the home, I got to know them and got to love on them a little bit. You know, and I find myself really, really, they're just so perfect. Handicapped children are just so perfect. And I can remember walking in there, you know, and I can remember, you know, just dealing with what I had to. And almost always when I'd go, I'd set myself up. So I'd go, I'd stay for a little bit, and then I'd run to a women's meeting. You know, I would do that. And I would kind of like strategically, all these emotional things, I'd have a backup plan. You know, I'd do what I had to do, and then boom, back, you know, to the B plan. And I started to acquire that relationship with him and get back into his life, and I going to his house. So now I'm knowing the house. And he was in the same home for a lot of years, so it was really, really fortunate for me. Never once did they say, oh, you can't go over there, or you've lost all. The reason why I lost my parental rights wasn't their choice, it was my choice. I just couldn't show up, so I had to forge it. And I was never, I can remember when I was drinking and using, if you get a 5150, you're not allowed to be around people like that, alone with them. And I can remember being in some pretty, you know, gnarly scrapes where God, like, brought me to, you know. And I know the sole purpose was so that I wouldn't lose those rights, because me under the influence, I'll lose them, I'll give them away. And I was able to go to his house, and then I took this commitment at this women's sober living house. I remember I had a solid 3 years of sobriety. And there was a gentleman in my life, I was in a relationship because Dennis had passed away and he was diagnosed with cancer. And I was able to suit up and show up for him. But as you guys know, with the cancer comes along some medication, and medication that our disease likes. And pretty soon, the relationship being what it was, the cancer on one hand and the disease got bigger than the cancer, and I had to go. So I did what every tough chick does. I went home and lived with my sponsor for a couple months. And that's when I got the opportunity to manage the sober living house. So when they asked me to do that, and I talked to Roxy, she said, yeah, it'd be a good idea. It actually put me in Garden Grove. And then no more than 2 weeks later, after I made that move, got kind of sort of settled, get to know the girls a little bit, God actually blessed me with the idea of my son's school was across the street and around the corner. So now I could go by every day before work or after work, whichever case may be, while he was at school, and I already knew the people at his home. Then I started doing the doctor thing with him and just really honestly trying to show up the best that I could for him. You know, and I can remember talking to God in my prayers and some of my writings, because by now he's a grown man, you know. And I mean, when he was growing up, like, I could lift him and no problem, and we could do this and we can do that. But now he's a grown man, you know. About 20 years old, and started to really, really work on that relationship quite a bit. And what helped me do that was because this gentleman who had cancer, he was so ungrateful for all the stuff that I did for him. And I just think about, well, when I spend time with my son, at least he's grateful for it. So it made me even more so want to do that, you know? So then God gave me that opportunity. And this one thing that I learned from that relationship is that my disease, because I've seen it in him, doesn't know the difference whether I'm going to Chewy or I'm getting a prescription filled. It's still the same disease. I never really swayed that line together. I never really made that. I knew, okay, one thing of anything for me, I'm done. But I never really made that, like, wow, we have choices. There comes a time when we have to be responsible for our own recovery, our own outcome. You know, and being in that situation with the gentleman who had cancer, you know, it just helped me to find more of who I was and what I was capable of and how strong I was with the women's help around me and the people around me. And his name's Bobby Ligori. The dude was funny. We used to have so much fun. And, you know, he died from the cancer this time. And, you know, he told me that going into it. And I don't know, it was just a situation of being able to suit up and show up for a lot of different ordeals. And this little boy became sick, and Joshua, we rekindled our relationship. I'm trying to look away just because. We rekindled our relationship as best that we could, and I had such a good relationship with him that I was able to tell them that we were seriously losing his spirit. The doctors are just fixing him and sending him home, You know, the infections were coming back, and he was never going to get in his wheelchair again, and he was never going to go to school, and the quality of his life was never going to be the little tiny crap quality that he had was changing. And it was 4 months before he passed, and I told the doctors that, and I told his therapist that, and they agreed with me. You know, what they did was when he got really, really sick and somebody had to make the decisions, because of the relationships that I helped participate in with this, they gave me all those rights back. Like, I tried to become his advocate, but they wanted like $6,000 to do it. And I couldn't, there's no way I could feasibly come up with that kind of money. So on that, and knowing that, it wasn't even a thought of I wanted to make these final arrangements for him. I knew it was impossible. These are things that don't happen for a chick like me. I had my chance. I wasn't going to get that back. You know, I just needed to show up like I could. And for some reason, God's grace and you people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys gave that back to me. And the state of California allowed me to make all those arrangements for him. You know, and I'm not supposed to have that. You know, I'm not supposed to have that. And it's a cool deal. And so I have closure on that. I have complete closure on that. I was the last one to hold Dennis's ashes when the prison finally sent him home. With spinal meningitis, they have to cremate the body right then and there, so there's no way to get him back, like, on a plane. Physically, they wanted him cremated right then and there. And when we did his in 2003, there was a couple of spots by his where his final resting spot is. And I went down. I didn't know I would need it so soon, but I went down and started praying on this little spot right next to Dennis. So I have Dennis and Joshua right in the same spot. And I was the last one to hold their ashes and put them in their final resting spot. And you people did that for me. And there's no way I could repay you people for the life that you've given me. And that's just the truth. You know, you get really, really busy, and it's like it's not such a big deal. And then when you try to, like, put words to it and articulate it to people, it's freaking huge. It's freaking huge. You know, it's just been an honor and a privilege. And so Joshua passed away in 2006, and I was living in my own little one-bedroom apartment. And, you know, I have people around me all the time. I won't make a move unless I know I have people around me supportive. And there's quite a few apartments over there, and I don't know exactly how many there was, but I had some really awesome neighbors, you know, and I have a couple of few girls who are around the program, then in the program, and then when they're out, they're really, really out. And if you don't have any of those in your life, stick around for a while, because you'll get them, you know. And I can tell you that it was Thursday and Friday, and I had a speaker commitment. I was the speaker getter for a Thursday night meeting at the Garden Grove Club. And right after Joshua passed away, I kept his ashes on his stuffed animals, the animals that were propping him up when he took his last breath. And I seen a grieving counselor, because, you know, I know, like, really crazy people don't know they're crazy. So I wanted to make sure everything was okay, and they offered a grievance counselor. And when I got his ashes back, I, like, propped him up on the back of the couch, and I kept him for 11 months. I wasn't ready to give him up. They told me it didn't matter how I do it as long as I did it. And I kept that little boy for another year before I placed him in his final resting spot. And I placed him in his final resting spot on spring. I thought that would be appropriate to let him go. And I was really wholeheartedly okay with the idea of letting him go and being there, you know. And but he lives on, you know. Things got really, really crazy, and they got dark, and I had commitments, and I'm suiting up, and I'm showing up, and I have some awesome friends in my life that carried me on some days, you know, as little extracurricular activities and going to you know, conferences and conventions and whatever the case may be. Wherever we can go, we just go. And there's always room in the car. You know, there's always room in the car. And when the night that he took his last breath, Nick Murray, we were talking about him earlier. He's an amazing man. If you haven't had the chance to meet him, you will, because he's busy and he's everywhere. And he asked me if I would be the main speaker. And it was April 8th. And he asked me if I would be the main speaker. And here we'd already made the final arrangements for Joshua. They told me it was going to be anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months, depending on how long he held on. You know, and we placed him on a Tuesday. The nurse came and seen him on a Wednesday. Thursday's doing okay. Friday, kind of, sort of. I went back to work, and Nick asked me to speak on that Saturday night, and I had already went back to work because my boss is really, really cool. And what I would do is I'd get the our residents, I would get them into whatever group they were doing, and I'd sneak out the front, jump in the car, and we placed Joshua's hospital like really, really close, like probably like 4 minutes away where he was at. And I'm just sharing this with you because this helps you understand the impact of why I love to do this stuff. And so I would sneak out, and I can tell you that a newcomer drove me because I was so shaky and out of sorts. It's kind of cool that I can have a job where I can be going through something that traumatic and be around a bunch of people that are newly sober and they don't even know. They knew because there's no secrets with me, you know, and I have some love and some condolence, but yet I need to be the strong one, you know. It wasn't like I was a blubbering idiot in the corner bawling my eyes out. I was just suiting up and showing up like you people taught me to do, carrying a message, trying to help the new man, new woman, whatever the case may be. And I do that. I work real hard, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit. How much time do I have left? 10 minutes? Okay, fast forward. Okay, so, but Nick Murray asked me to speak that night, and I was hearing the message at the meeting place, which is not nowhere near as amazing as this, but there's still alcoholics in there, and they're broken, and they need to hear the message. And then when I got done speaking, Roxy was there with Josh so he wouldn't be alone, because that's how AA does it. And Roxy and Steve were on their actual first date. Steve had asked Roxy out. She'd been saying no forever. She decided to go out, but she said, yeah, I'll go out with you. We're going to sit next to a little man's bed while his mom carries the message of alcoholics and all. She set that boy up, huh? Come into my life, you know. But anyway, he took his last breath. I wasn't there. She said, on the radio, she said he went very, very peaceful. He just kind of looked up. At 6 o'clock, I went and seen him. At about 8:30, my brother-in-law went and gave him a clean shaven. Had one of the girls in the program was learning to be a masseuse, so she went over there and gave him a massage. And he went home, you know? And he went home. And who does that song? No, never mind. I can't remember right now. This must not be that big a deal. Okay. So there was a song on the radio, but it happened to be by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was complete circle. He had nice music. Everybody did what they did. And he took his last breath, and Roxy told me to get there. And, you know, he was gone when I got there. And I believe that if I had been there, my voice may have kept him around a little bit longer. But that Friday morning, I remember talking to God because his breathing has changed. It's a really, really ugly thing to see when somebody passes. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of people in the room have seen that. And, you know, there's some thoughts and some, you know, just some images that I have in my mind that I could really live without. And I remember talking to God, and I remember asking God, God, please don't let him suffer anymore. You know, and that was on Friday morning. And then Saturday night, he took his last breath while I was carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So fast forward a little bit, managing another sober living house, kind of crazy, 8 years sober, involved with somebody who's doing all that street stuff, and I'm living vicariously, like picking bar fights, and I'm not even drunk, and putting my foot to his head because that's the kind of girl I am. And but I didn't put my hands on nobody, you know what I mean? So things got really, really crazy, and I, you know, me and my sponsor weren't meeting, weren't catching up. I was doing a lot of service work, and I asked this other awesome lady to sponsor me. And I knew she was awesome because I've been watching her from afar. One of our alumni actually married her into the family. And this was her first suggestion to me, is that I give up all my commitments. Doing a whole bunch of quantity and no quality, is what I was told. But I listened to her, and we went through the 12 steps again. And shortly after that, I was at the tri-state, and there's a gentleman that I've seen throughout the years, over the years, in and out of our treatment facility. He's alumni. And it just so happens that it's funny, but his oldest son was like the constant kid when I was first getting sober. The constant kid, you know, the kid that's in a meeting every single night of the week with his mom. And for years, I got to watch that little boy. And this alumni member of Woodglen, like, went away, went to Arizona, moved to Redlands, went out away, you know, while I got sober is how I look at it. And I got to watch his boy grow while he was away. And he'd come and get him on the weekends, and I kind of sort of see him. And then Boomer told me, he said, Paula, why don't you get with somebody who's got time in the program? And I thought, wow, what a concept. He said that about 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks before. And we went to the Tri-State Roundup, and this guy that I knew, I recognized, you know, we're the Tri-State Roundup. I think it was the first time I went even that year. You know, it was the first time I went. I went with Roxy, her and Mike Fashawn, and we went over there, and I was kind of like running around. It was funny because I put my motorcycle boots in the back of the car and I said, I'm having fun this weekend. I'm going to have a good time this weekend. I deserve it. And we got over there and he asked me if he could use his lip gloss or some kind of crazy stuff. And then he kind of sort of hit on me. I thought, wow, that's kind of weird. But I remember asking him, I said, why did you wait so far away from Woodglen for you to hit on me? And he said, because when you're at Woodglen, you're like a pit bull. I caught you with your hair down. I was just glad that he knew that about me. You know what I mean? Because that's a job there, you know? My job there a lot of times is to keep them safe from themselves and them safe from each other, you know? And we got a lot of sick crew that comes by over there. You can't exactly be nice and keep that place together. Not really. I know how to do it nice today, but it wasn't always like that, huh, Chucky? So he hit on me, and Miss Barbara had me do some step work, and I found out in that 12 steps that I actually had some skills and some abilities, and I wasn't quite as twisted as I thought. And maybe there's an opportunity for me to have a somewhat normal life, you know? And another thing about me not having all those commitments is it actually allowed me the opportunity to sit in that sober living house with them women and see how crazy my life is. Because I wasn't so busy out running around, you know, but it really gave me some standstill time and, you know, regrow, and got to prune away some things, and some more beautiful flowers came in. And everything in my life that's good is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, when I say I'm an alcoholic, there's a sense of responsibility that comes along with that, you know. I, not even like 6 months ago, I went to Kaiser Permanente and I got a mental health checkup just because crazy people don't know they're crazy. And, you know, we really don't. And that's true. Crazy people don't think that they're crazy. It takes people around them to tell them, hey, you're headed in the wrong direction, you know. So they don't lock us up for thinking crazy. They lock us up for acting crazy. And on that note, I don't know how much of the time I had, and I'm sure it's funny about us alcoholics. I mean, I know a lot of you guys have probably spoke, you know, small meetings, big meetings, it don't matter, panels, it don't matter. There's so much to do around here. And you start to share your story, and I honestly believe that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, or NA, CMA, NEA, as long as it keeps away the DA, you know, we like that. So when we come in here and we have a situation, no matter how big or how small it is, it's this huge to me in my head. And I come into a meeting, or I'm sharing my experience, or I'm healing, and it's like it's manageable again. And if you have something going on and you need to heal, you need to let somebody know, because there's a magic healing that happens in here. You'll hear people call it the language of the heart. You know, there's just so many things that you'll hear around here, you know. Nothing I said is original. I do have a story that I knew was a good story when I got here, and I stuck around long enough for God to make it a better story. You know, this disease is a family disease. It goes from one generation to the next. I do not make good decisions when I'm under the influence, you know, and for no other reason at all. A couple of months ago, I was talking with one of my girls, and her man had passed away. And we hear a lot of times around here some of the step work we do, the letters we write to the ones that we can't talk to, and there's a lot of healing in that. But I was encouraged to actually sit down and write, oh God, here goes this, and write a letter to me from Joshua, you know, and not trying to anything. See, today I know my part, you know, I know what I'm accountable for. It was kind of challenging because he couldn't talk, so I had to place it like, if he could talk. And what he told me is keep suiting up and showing up and fighting this against this disease, because when I'm doing that, he's living on. And that's the closure of the last couple of sentences of it. And then, you know, it's an honor and privilege you guys having us out here. Hope I didn't let anybody down. You know, if I did, call your sponsor, it's good practice. I hope you have a sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, please get one. Please get one. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous comes to life. The magic about that book is it finally gave me words to thoughts and feelings I had no idea. I didn't even know how to express it until that book and you people showed me how to do that. I know God's not done yet. I'm a freaking high maintenance. I'm a full-time job. You know, I have people around in my life that love me, and I think one of the best gifts that I've gotten is I may not have nothing that you want, but I have everything that I want. And that's a magical journey for a chick like me. And I'll leave you on this note, maybe a little bit of humor. Maybe some of you will get it, some of you won't. The monkey may be off my back, but the circus is still in town. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.